Okay, so thanks very much. My name is Andy Clifton. I work just down the road at the National Renewable Energy Lab. I'd like to straight away acknowledge two of my co-authors on this, Carolina Draxel and Brian Matthias Hodge. They're actually the experts on this. I'm just the volunteer to present. So I'll quite happily take all of the good stuff, and if you've got any questions or complaints, please talk to them. What I want to talk about is the Wind Integration National Dataset, or what we call the Wind Toolkit. It's a renewable energy integration product, and what that means, well, it's easier to recognize the characteristics of this product than it is to actually explain it. It's something that's got very high spatial resolution, it's got long duration, and it's got realistic energy generation characteristics. So what we've done there is we've put actual wind turbines in. I'm going to talk a little bit more, or a lot more, about the details of what's in there in a minute. The other important thing is that it's a very large spatial extent. Typically, a renewable energy integration data set should cover several hundred kilometers, or at least an ISO or a balancing authority. And in this case, what we're going to present is something that covers the entirety of the continental US. I have to be very honest, this is not just NREL by any means. This is a product that was produced by the then three-tier, now part of ISILA, for NREL, DOE-funded. It was run on the systems at Sandia and at NREL, the HPC systems that we have. And I think several people in this room were actually involved in giving us advice as a sort of guidance board or a steering committee, if you like. Those of you who are familiar with other integration data sets will know what's in those. The difference between the older generation and the new generation that we're presenting here is that we have gone very hard towards producing a seamless data set. So what I'm going to show is something that's based on WARF. It's based on downscaling, nesting. It would be very easy to generate temporal or spatial boundaries within that data set. We tried very hard to avoid that. We've also gone very hard to validate this data. A lot of the validation has been done against proprietary data. What I'm going to present here is against the relatively few public data sets that we have. We're using wind turbine generator power curves that are optimized for specific sites. And most importantly, I think for this audience, the data is freely available online, so you're very welcome to go out and play with it. So I've said a lot about the characteristics, but what actually is the Wind Toolkit? Well, there are four main things in there. There are four sort of bodies, if you like. There are site-specific wind turbine choices. There is a weather time series, which we're going to use to drive those wind turbines to figure out the amount of energy that we gather. And that gives us a power time series. And the one thing I'm not going to talk about today is the bottom right, which is the forecast time series. If you do have questions about that, I direct you to either Brian Matthias or Caroline. And we've frozen. Just a minute. Okay. Good. So the first thing that we had to do was figure out where we were going to put all the wind turbines. And to do that, what we did is we started with a representative 30-year map from, in this case, three-tier. There are similar products available from AWS in the US, and a variety of European companies also offer something similar. And that gives you the mean wind speed, and it gives you the Weibull parameters for a 2 kilometer by 2 kilometer grid. That means that what you can do is you can drop wind turbines into that grid, and you can choose the most appropriate wind turbine for each of your grid cells. You can apply exclusions, so say national parks or slope angles, and then you can come up with a picture for the entirety of the US of where the feasible locations are for wind turbines. This is completely ignoring the market. The other thing that we do is we also include the offshore waters around the US where we're going up to 30 meters in depth, and we end up with something like 126,000 grid cells that have wind turbines installed in them. So that's where the wind turbines came from, the locations came from. The thing that we need for driving the energy output, obviously, is the weather time series. So I mentioned that we were aiming to get something that's seamless in time and space. And the way that we've done that is we've got a very, very big inner domain. What we're doing here is we're nesting from era interim down to 18 kilometers and then 6 kilometers and 2 kilometers. And what we're doing is we're doing a 1 month run at a time. We have a 48 hour spin up a 1 month run, and we're writing data out every 5 minutes at 2 kilometer resolution. We're also writing data out at many, many different heights, and then we're interpolating that across the rotor disk so that we have these 8 heights across the rotor disk. So a huge amount of data. 16 gigabytes per 5 minute write out, 100 terabytes in total. This is something where you need to work very carefully with your IT specialists. And then we run it through a power curve. So I talked about using the maps of the US to figure out what turbines we were going to put where. And we have generic class 1 through 3 wind turbine power curves, which are based off of comparable industry machines. And we apply those to each of the grid cells. And we apply a power curve as well for the offshore sites. And then we do something which is a little bit interesting if you're involved in resource assessment. We try to figure out the wake effects. Now, rather than just subtracting an amount of energy for the wake effects, what we actually do is we adjust the wind speed in the cell. So you have a relatively low effect in region 3, which is to the right of rated. Let's see where I can get a cursor. So in this area to the right, there's not going to be much effect from wakes. The bigger effect from wakes is going to be in region 2, where the power output from the turbine is scaling with the cube of the wind speed. So we're getting there. We've got the building blocks that we need. The other thing that we need is we need a way to get this data out to users. So we've put together a web interface. And you can see here a map of the US. This is all of the sites colored by capacity factor. Red is the highest, and blue is relatively low. To give you context, the reds here are coming in at around 0.5, 0.55 on the capacity factor. The blues are anything from, I think, 0.2 to 0.35. So there are some great features here. There's the wind corridor is very, very visible at the center of the country, across into the northeast as well. What that also reflects is the ability to choose an appropriate turbine for the site and to optimize the turbine. Interestingly, there's also quite a lot of potential down in the southeast, where there are currently really not very many turbines installed. So the next thing that you can do is you can start to drill in a little bit. And this is looking at just south of Boulder. We're underneath the white box in the middle and down towards the wind site, the National Wind Technology Center. And you can see we've got a bunch of turbines there. Some of you will say, well, why are your turbines going up into the mountains? That's a good question. The issue is that we generate the turbine locations and all of our data on a 2 kilometer resolution map. So inevitably, there are places where you do things like smooth out the flat irons. Not great, but it happens. We give you the opportunity to download data. So you can go in, you can find an area of interest, and you can pull down the data. That's the metadata and the power data. You can even pull down the forecast data as well. Because we'd rather you didn't use up all of our bandwidth, we also impose a limit there. And that's just what we're showing here with this blue bar. So obviously, once you've got the data, the temptation is to figure out how good it is. This is the site that I work at. And we have a couple of very good resources on site. The best one for doing a validation of a long-term data set is something that we call the M2 tower. It's an 80-meter tower. We also have, just as a plug for what else I do, we have 135-meter towers on site where you can also get turbulence information as well if you're interested. The challenge with that site is that it's very, very close to the mountains. So it would be reasonable to expect that there are local effects which are not caught in a relatively coarse 2 kilometer simulation. And that's absolutely valuable. But for a grid integration project, you're not too interested in the really local effects. You're interested more in sort of the county level or the regional effects. So we're interested in things like, did we get the wind speed right? Did we get the wind speed distribution right? And this is just a comparison of the distributions, observations versus models. And the model is probably slightly overpredicting the wind speed at this location. But given the complexity of the site and the relative coarseness of the model, this is an amazing agreement, I think. And we've done it for a bunch of sites. We've done this validation elsewhere. So this map, concentrate on the yellow stars. Those are the sites where we've got publicly accessible validation data between about 50 and 100 meters. There's a desperate paucity of data in the US. frankly. There's a lot more power data, which I'm also going to discuss. Anyway, so we can do the validation there. And I've just pulled out three sites where we've looked at the diurnal curves, the diurnal cycle, and we've looked at the annual cycle. The site observations are the solid lines, the dashed lines are the model. It's not great. There is a bias in there, but what is good from a grid integration standpoint is we're capturing the variability. And we've looked at this in quite some detail. One of the caveats about this data is that it shouldn't be used as a resource assessment data set, and this is part of the reason why this slight bias in places. But anyway, we can look at the power as well. So we can draw a box around a whole bunch of turbines, and in this case we've gone for a 300 megawatt site, and we've looked at the power curve, and we're just asking, is the power curve reasonable? And it is. It shows us the features that we would expect from reality, so slight overprediction at low wind speeds, slight overperformance at low wind speeds compared to the average power curve. Somebody looking at me quizzically, I haven't explained this very well. What we're looking at here is on the x-axis, it's the mean wind speed for the site. On the y-axis, it's the normalized power, so you could think about this being up to 300 megawatts. Because you have a wide range of powers, wind speeds across the site, you have a wide range of power that could be producing, and that gives you, at low wind speed, that gives you overperformance compared to the average power curve, and towards rated, it gives you slight underperformance. The other thing that we have on the right-hand side, there's this points cloud coming in down here, and that's due to high wind speed hysteresis. So as you go above 25 meters per second on some of your turbines need to shut off to protect themselves, and they don't turn back on until the wind speeds drop back below 20 meters per second. So these are important features for integrating wind turbines into a power grid, because you end up with a lot of variability, a lot of fluctuation. And you see this particularly in when you look at the variability. So this is plotting here the variability of the power in blue and the absolute power in, the average power in red. And this is for the plains states, so Texas through to the Canadian border going north. And you see a lot of variability in terms of delta power over delta T in the shoulder hours. Remember, it takes a couple of hours for sunrise and sunset to work their way across those plains. Relatively little variability during the night when the wind resource is fairly strong and reliable, and again, relatively little during the day, but there just isn't that much resource there. I'll skip the capacity factors, the global capacity factors, and we'll focus instead on what happens when you look, when you aggregate a bunch of wind turbines in an existing ISO and you compare them to the performance of existing generators there. So the red is our data set, the blue is the data that we've got from, in this case, ERCOT. And it's interesting. You see that we are predicting a slightly higher capacity factor than ERCOT. We're showing the same seasonal effects, though. The reason that we have a higher capacity factor is because our turbines are taller. We have the ability to optimize our turbines for a 2 kilometer by 2 kilometer grid cell rather than going for the same turbine right across the grid, across the plant. We probably have more turbines. There's no curtailment. There are no losses. And so altogether, those things add up to about a 10% overperformance compared to the existing turbine fleet. And that's exactly what you see in that gap there. So I talked about good ways to use the Wind Toolkit. It's great for grid integration. It is a long-term, high-resolution data set. It would be very tempting, though, to use this for resource assessment. I think Jake, for example, presented a very good example of how you could look at very high resolution wind data and use it to spur development. This is probably not ideal for that because we are not really resolving the fine terrain. We do have a little bit of a bias in our data set, as I've pointed out. We're not really correctly accounting for wakes in the same way that you would do for a resource assessment. But importantly, we are getting all of the variability in the generators, we're getting all of the diurnal cycles, we're getting all of the seasonal cycles, we're getting all of the high-frequency noise. So it's great as a grid integration data set. We're going to use it for grid integration studies in-house and to support DOE. you are welcome to use it for whatever you want to. So with that, I will close up and invite questions, I think.
It was about the meteorology sort of questions that you could actually see some interesting effects. For example, like wind farms, which are affected by the nocturnal low-level jets. And I'm wondering if this could be used for investigating which locations are much affected by that, and if they're well predicted in the WARF model. Also, I'm very interested what happens when you might have terrain and nocturnal low-level jets interacting. So maybe it'd be interesting to sort of browse that data set for that purpose. Do you have any comments on that?
Absolutely. This is all part of an ongoing project, or it will be part of more projects in the future. And there will be areas where the low-level jet is a significant part of the resource. And so obviously we would want to dig into this at those locations and check that we've got it right. Where it gets challenging is the complete lack of data in areas where the low-level jet comes through. So there is not really very much, if anything, available in the way of public data to the east of the Rockies at the right height for us to do that work. Yeah. We can probably mine a couple of intensive campaigns that have been done in the past, but we're really struggling to find that data.
Okay, thanks.
So there's two aspects. Did everybody hear the question? What's wrong with the data? Is data available or is it closely guarded? It's kind of both of those. So the three-tier did a validation of this data against their proprietary data that they have access to from wind plants. We are obliged to do a validation against publicly available data. There is not an awful lot of publicly available data in the US at the 50 to 150 meters. It would be great if we could get access to more of that, and I think there is definitely an argument to be made for talking with wind energy companies about trying to get more site data into the public domain, and that's an ongoing discussion as well.
Any more questions? Do you have one last question then? Because the reanalyses, you're using a bit into it.
Yeah. We would love to repeat this, I think. We learned a lot. We started doing this, I think, back in 2010 or 2011. I think it's fair to say that we would not necessarily do it exactly the same as we've done it before. If somebody is willing to finance us to do it again, great, bring it on.